This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you have insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds. And James Comer has finally admitted in writing that the vibes-based Biden impeachment hearings have been defeated. We have such a great show for you today. Lawyer Roberta Kaplan and Imran Ahmed, who is the founder for Countering Digital Hate, talk to us about their victory over one Elon Musk in court. Then we're joined by Slate senior editor Dahlia Lithwick to talk about the horrors of today's Supreme Court oral arguments on Mifepristone. But first, we have former senator and host of the Al Franken podcast, the one, the only Al Franken. Welcome back to Fast Politics, my friend Al Franken.
Hi, Molly.
Hi. There's a lot of depressing shit going on right now, but there are like these little green shoots that are kind of like spring a little bit. Go with me here.
Okay.
So I'm thinking, because you're like, what?
No, I'm excited. I'm excited for the green shoots.
I always try to be like a little...
It's spring.
Right. I'm also a very depressive person. So
that I know.
I always am trying to... Not completely, unlike you, who is happy and cheerful.
I think of you as a happy person.
Well, thank you. But I'm thinking about like Lisa Murkowski, right?
Mm-hmm.
And last week she said something to the effect of, I'm not getting on this clown car. You know her. You've served with her. I'm curious what your take on that was.
Well, she's in Alaska. She, I believe it was two elections ago, she had to run sort of as an independent anyway.
And a write-in.
And a write-in, yeah. And she won. And I think she realizes that she doesn't have to be a Republican. She can be an independent. I don't know who she'll caucus with. It'd be great if she caucused with the Democrats. But I see no problem for her being an independent.
There are these states where it's just everything you think about American politics is completely different. But so this is what she said. She said she's not voting for Trump and she's very independent minded and I'm navigating my way through some interesting political times. Let's just leave it at that. And she did not close the door to becoming an independent.
Yeah, I don't think she pays a price for that in Alaska. I think Alaskans like independence. I think she'd be fine doing that. And it really would be a question who she caucuses with. Especially if this election, we lose a couple seats. I mean, you know, we could get down to 49 Democrats, and if she decides to caucus with Democrats, then we'd be back to 50, and if the president is still Biden and the vice president is still Harris, then we have the vote. And so it could mean all the difference in the world and who has a majority and who's the majority leader.
I'm thinking about Angus King. There are Republicans who have been like, no, this is too insane for me. Not in the House, obviously, because too insane is the brand, but in the Senate.
You know the House much better than I do. What the hell's going on there? Now they're down to one, right? I mean, it's like it really is like a very badly written political drama that it's down to one now. It's crazy.
It's Alpha House without any likable characters. It's Veep without the sort of humor. So I would say what happened here is that when McCarthy left, he had a 5-seat majority. And again, McCarthy knew what he was doing, right? He pissed off a lot of Democrats, so he never was going to have the votes if Republicans turned on him, which was strategically stupid. And you know McCarthy, or at least I assume you know McCarthy. I think of him as a very stupid fellow.
Mm-hmm. I didn't think of him as a super bright guy, but I didn't know well enough to think of him that way.
He's no Louis Gohmert.
Oh.
We should establish the floor, which is like a Louis Gohmert or a Tommy Tuberville. That's the bottom.
He's not there.
Yeah, he's a little smarter than that. But I would think, so what I would say is what happened was Matt Gaetz, first of all, had this Gaetz 8 that threw him out. Matt Gaetz had a huge fundraising bump from that. So already, like, throughout this entire time, the House has been rewarded for bad, stupid behavior with small dollar donors. So, I mean, I think that's like an interesting motivator when you look at this. And they put in Mike Johnson, who was Trump's guy, right, because of his work on the 2020 election.
Yeah, he had filed a brief, right, for the Supreme Court to revisit the election.
It was the idea that you could just throw out all your votes in your state if you wanted to. Even this Supreme Court was like too much.
Yeah, please don't involve us in this, please.
Right, which is like we're trying to destroy the EPA and we want to take away women's reproductive rights. But even this is too much for us.
Yeah.
So that crew then, so they put him in again. Like, I mean, I wonder always how much this has to do with Trump, right? Like everything Trump touches
turns to gold.
Exactly.
And think the opposite.
So Trump puts him in. He decides to run not one, but two impeachments. And the rest is history.
Yeah. How's the Biden impeachment going?
Vibes based, baby. Vibes based. It's always a bad sign. I'm not a lawyer, but it's always a bad sign when your witness is in jail.
Yeah. Well, they have to keep him in jail so he won't flee the country, right?
Right, yeah. In their defense.
In his defense. I'm only in jail. I'm only in jail because they're afraid I'll flee the country. I didn't commit a crime, I contend, but I'm only in prison so that I don't flee the country.
It's hard to argue with that, you know?
No, well, this is that guy. What's his name?
His name is Smirnoff, like the vodka.
I had a little key to that to remember that, but I wasn't thinking vodka, of course.
It's Smirnov, not like the vodka.
Smirnov. It's the same. Thank you. It's very close. It's like one letter. He's so mean, this producer we have. But yes, I think we would have actually gotten in a lot of trouble for calling him Smirnoff, whatever.
It'd be a smear.
That's right. I mean, the poor guy's already in jail. And I would like to add that the FBI had sort of flagged him as a very bad bet. You know, like, remember, the beginning of this was that Republicans were like, we know there's someone who has this dirt. And the head of the FBI sort of slow rolled it and they got furious. And it turns out that was because this guy, they knew he was incredible. So I feel like that's an amazing little bit of.
And I believe his name is Smirnov.
Smirnov.
I believe that. I wanted to correct you.
Anyway, So the point is, this guy, so now Comer has this theory that he can refer this to the DOJ and that for a criminal charge, and that somehow that will make it seem like he hasn't completely fucked up. And he actually sent a fundraising email.
He's referring Smirnov to the...
No, he's referring Biden and Hunter. Poor Hunter. He has two things, right? The tax thing and the gun thing.
Right.
And for both... Right. The gun thing was that he put the gun in a trash thing behind a school and he didn't get rid of it the right way.
That seems very irresponsible.
Very irresponsible. And
where would you put a gun? By a school?
I'm not defending him, but the gun and the taxes and both things he's had like been charged for. I mean, there has been a lot of like the man has really been charged more than he probably would have been had he been just a normal moron.
Yeah.
If that's fair.
That's how they get to Biden, is going after the son. And also what's bad about him is that he's 54. So he reminds people that the president has a son who's 54 years old.
Yeah, but he looks good. I mean, I don't want to get too stupid here. But anyway, the point is, Comer actually sent a fundraising email last day or two on this idea that he was going to refer these. And this is like what they think of as their off-ramp to this impeachment, is that they're going to do this and it's going to look like they really did this. But they really didn't do anything. And then they have this the other impeachment, the Mayorkas impeachment, which actually... You know, it's the first time in 164 years that a cabinet member has been impeached. Again, it's like they never read the rest of the statute, high crimes and misdemeanors, right? So you can't just impeach them for like you don't like the policy. Like, that's not how any of this works.
Did you read these articles of impeachment? I mean, I didn't. Did you? I mean,
they're written in, I can't read crayon. Yeah, I'm sorry. Look, Trump was very mad that he had been impeached twice. And he figured at least one impeachment would make up for that.
Well, I got it. But I actually don't know what the charges are. But they have to come up with something. So what are they? That he carried out policy that they didn't vote for or something like that? It must be something.
I'm going to look it up. Or Jesse's going to look it up if we are lucky.
You know, what it is that we had no interest in looking it up because we know how bogus it is. I mean, it'd be one thing if there was, okay, he's been impeached. There must be something serious. Let's see. No, we went, this is bogus. I'm not going to look it up.
I have it here. So let's see. Impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors. Okay. In violation of his constitutional oath, engaged in a pattern of conduct that is incompatible with his duties as officer of the United States as follows. Okay. Article 1. He did not ensure the laws passed by Congress and written into law for the Secure Fence Act of 2006, which requires the Secretary of Homeland Security to maintain operational control over the entire international land and maritime borders of the United States. The term operational control is defined as the prevention of all unlawful entries into the United States, including entries by terrorists, other unlawful aliens, instruments of terrorism, narcotics, and contraband.
They're basically saying people entered the country illegally, and therefore we impeach you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, it's a ballsy move in the fact that it makes, I think that's not how any of this works. But yeah, so I think it'll go to the Senate, and I think nothing will happen.
I actually do think that they will dispose of it sort of instantly, because the idea, the spectacle of a trial there, I think would be a Shonda for the
Shonda
for everybody. I mean,
see, if you know, you know.
No, I'm saying that the Senate is not going to want to have this, because it'll be a giant waste of time, and it'll also be embarrassing. I think actually having this trial would be very embarrassing for the Republicans. So I think both Republicans and the Democrats will want to go like, well, thank you very much, House, but no.
I think that's right. And I also think, you know, they put themselves in this. So
how many weeks has it been since they impeached him?
They impeached him 1/9/2023. So he introduced it a year ago, a little more than a year ago. They were very hot to impeach someone as soon as they got control of the House.
Right.
Which is incredible. But, you know, everybody now, the House is out for 2 weeks. The Senate is out for 2 weeks. Ukraine still has no money. You know, they're on the battlefields running out of munitions. I mean, there's still the question of like the money for, you know, it's just, it's really been interesting to me because like one of the things that I thought was kind of amazing was, you know, you did have over Christmas break, you had Chris Murphy and you had Kyrsten Sinema.
Langford, are you talking about the border?
The three of them negotiating a border bill, and they sort of called Republicans bluff in an amazing way.
Yeah, no, and then Trump said, no, I want it as an issue. And the Republicans backed off because dear leader wants this as an issue. So we're not going to pass something that actually does some good on from their point of view. We're not going to pass this. The question that I have is, does this work for Trump? Does this work as a border issue? And the answer, I think, is kind of yes. I mean, do Republicans, does his base, do they remember that there was a bill that addressed most of the issues? You know, Trump said, no, I'm going to do a perfect bill.
Exactly. I'm going to find a perfect solution. Like, there are other things that are coming out of the House that have, like, worked for Democrats to, I actually think the impeachment ends up working for Democrats and the kicking the can, because if the border is the biggest thing, why did you reject this bill that's very conservative, that's shut down the border and, you know, has these deportations? I mean, it has all the Republican fever dream stuff in it, negotiated by James Lankford. But I think what's interesting about this situation too is like the Republican study committee, 80% of the caucus, they are coming out with some of the most batshit, you know, they're going to raise retirement age. They're going to do all the things that voters hate, right? They're going to rethink Obamacare. You know, it's just like a laundry list of all this stupid shit.
You know, it's almost like they don't talk to each other. It's almost like, don't do that because that's what they accuse us of doing. No, we're going to do it anyway because that's what we think should be done. And you know, when you have a majority of one, it's chaos.
It also has been chaos this whole time, too. So it'll be interesting to see. But I think what is, you know, you got Kay Granger stepping off appropriations ASAP, right? Like you have these people with these very powerful positions being like, fuck it, it's not worth it. And then you have people like from Wisconsin, Mike Gallagher, who's like this sort of like, you know, that was supposed to be this generation's Paul Ryan. And he's like, I'm out, man. I'm going to go work for Peter Thiel at Palantir. Actually, Peter Thiel is not, I don't know that Peter Thiel still owns Palantir, but you know that, or still has a controlling stake. But you know, he's like, I'm out of here. I'm not even going to finish that.
I'm going to go get rid.
Yeah. Like, it's not worth it. Power is not worth it.
Well, it's just how much power is it, really? And it's just chaos. And Johnson, I remember I kept hearing like he's done it as many times as he can. He's defied the nutcases too many times. And then he did it again. And this was supposed to be the time that he'd be called on it and they'd get rid of him again, like they got rid of McCarthy. I don't know if there's an appetite for that either.
Well, as they were leaving, Marjorie Taylor Greene filed a motion to vacate, which she called both a pink slip and a warning, which I have to say, like the people who cover Congress try to be, you know, the sort of straight news people try to be right down the middle and not political in a certain way. And I heard one congressional reporter like being like, this person is a fucking moron. You can't have a pink slip. That's a warning.
Well, it is what it is. It's going to be 2 weeks of wondering what the hell she's thinking and talking about. And then when they get back, she'll try to figure out what she's thinking and talking. That's how I read it. She made her statement. That's the statement. That's what it is.
Right.
And she's going to either have to pull the trigger or not. And the thing is that McCarthy accepted that one member can pull the trigger.
Right. It's so stupid. I mean, just an impossible way to work.
But I think it's been that way before, but they haven't done it. And now this group decides it's something I can do. There's more than a few nutcases. So at any point that one nutcase decides to do it, they'll do it. So it's in her court, and we have to wait 2 weeks to see what she does.
Al Franken, thank you.
Well, I hope we solve something.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does the hard parts for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billings, scheduling, and more. With a home management team that provides support before, during, and after your stay so you can focus on the relaxing, hosting, and making memories with family and friends. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. With Picasso, you can stop saying someday and start building family traditions today in a vacation home you own and revisit time after time. Visit Picasso.com today to see thousands of luxury vacation home listings. That's PACASO.com.
When you have health insurance, it's easy to think, I'm covered, no worries, right? Well, not so fast. What about your out-of-pocket costs? That can be a lot of money for you and your family. And if you're like me, you can't help but wonder, was I overbilled? You're not alone. It's estimated that over 50% of medical bills contain errors. Unless you're a billing expert, how do you know your medical bills are accurate? That's why I want to tell you about HealthLock. What is HealthLock? It's a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your family's insurance. When your medical claims come in, HealthLock technology reviews the claims for errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. HealthLock makes it easy to find and fix hidden errors, so you pay only what you owe. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. Bottom line, insurance alone isn't enough. HealthLock finds medical bill errors before you pay. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider. Roberta Kaplan is a lawyer who represented E. Jean Carroll in her case against Donald Trump, as well as arguing United States versus Windsor. Imran Ahmed is the founder of Countering Digital Hate. Welcome to Fast Politics.
Hi, I'm Imran Ahmed. I'm chief executive of the Center for Countering Digital Hate.
Great. And...
And I'm Roberta, otherwise known as Robbie Kaplan, and I'm a lawyer and a partner at Kaplan, Hecker & Fink.
Yes. You guys are coming on today to talk about a very interesting case. So who wants to sort of set the stage on, maybe Imran, you want to just sort of paint the picture of what happened here?
Yeah. So my organization studies the dynamics by which hate and disinformation, the lies that underpin hate, are spread online. when Elon Musk took over X, he made it clear to people that he was putting up the bat signal for racists, for homophobes, for misogynists to come back to the platform. He actually unbanned tens of thousands of people who'd been banned previously. He reinstating their accounts. He, you know, made it clear that he wasn't going to enforce the rules. And we wanted to know, well, what does that effect does that have on a platform? So we did a study looking at how many times racial swear words like the N-word were being used on the platform in the week after he took over compared to the before he took over. And we found, for example, that anti-black swear words went up 202%. So they tripped in number. We found that anti-gay, anti-women, anti-Jew, anti-Muslim words went up substantially. And we published a report on it. It ended up on the front page of the New York Times. A bunch of advertisers, Elon Musk claims, read it and then wrote to him saying, we're pulling our advertising because of this article. And he subsequently sued us. We argue that we were just putting up a mirror to his platform and that if you don't like the image in a mirror, go for a haircut, have a shave. But he decided to sue the mirror.
And that is where Robbie comes in. Robbie, will you explain to us what happened next?
Yeah, so it was a really kind of interesting lead up to the actual filed complaint. And it was very revealing. Basically, first thing they did is they had one lawyer kind of basically threatened us with a pseudo-defamation claim. He said that he was going to be, it came under the Lanham Act, which has to do with false advertising. We wrote back and said, forget it, that's ridiculous, no claim, go for it. Then another lawyer showed up, and this ended up being very important to the judge's ultimate decision. The other lawyer brings a complaint that has nothing to do with defamation. It alleges technical contract violations and statutory violations having to do with how CCDH got these tweets, which were public tweets on Twitter. There was any secret information. And why that ended up being so important to the judge, he said, look, if you had a defamation claim, that would be one thing, but you're studiously avoiding saying that there was anything inaccurate in what CCDH reported. So therefore, this is clearly just a case to stifle speech.
This is not the first time you've sort of represented people being kind of punished for having information, if that makes sense. You know, you've worked on the Eugene Carroll case, so you have gone, you know, sort of into the lion's den. But I'm just curious, Elon Musk is, or he was the first or second richest person in the world. I mean, even though this case seems on the merit pretty flimsy, does he have great lawyers or...
So first of all, I looked it up last night. I think he's now the third richest person in the world.
Oh.
But that's still pretty rich,
prayers.
Say the least. That's
still
really rich. I think when you're that rich, there are lawyers who will work for you no matter what. But what was really interesting here is that the first group of lawyers obviously, for whatever reason, didn't feel comfortable bringing the case that was actually brought because, as the judge pointed out, it was such a ridiculous case.
Well, one of the things that really comes across to me is that this is not a man who is taking good advice from smart people because, I mean, this all kicked off with him replying to one of those Twitter files journalists in quotation marks, calling me a rat on his platform, you know, calling CCDH, the Center for Countering Digital Hate, an evil organization, him calling up the chair of my board and demanding a meeting. And the chair of my board said, no, you speak to the CEO. You know, this is a guy who's kind of behaving in a really erratic and really frenetic way, almost unhinged, you know. And then the day after he tried to contact the chair of my board and I said, you know, and he told him to talk to me, he then this initial complaint came in from one set of lawyers. And after we responded to one set of lawyers, within days, he'd come up with a new lawsuit, which came in from a second set of lawyers. And the difference, I think, you know, ironically for me, is that even though I run an organization with only 30 staff, we're a nonprofit. We had Roberta on our side. We had a whole bunch of professionals and we dealt with it in a sort of smart and calibrated way. And that's why he's ended up being comprehensively defeated.
Do you have thoughts on this, Robbie?
Look, you know, I've said this before, and I'll say it again. I think we are all living right now in an age of bullies.
Right.
Now, there have been bullies throughout history, that's for sure. What makes it so dangerous today is that social media provides a weapon that bullies can use that is really unique in the history of humankind and is incredibly destructive and incredibly dangerous. And the idea that groups like Imran's group, our client CCDH, who are trying to tell people the truth about the misinformation, the hate, the disinformation on social media, and then to have someone like Elon Musk turn around and sue them, which really was a huge crisis for them. I mean, as Imran said, they're not-for-profits. They're not rolling in dough. It just shows how dangerous this kind of behavior is. In other words, the lawsuit, in a way, was just an extension of Elon's bullying. And again, I think Judge Breyer saw through that and pointed it out in his opinion.
By the way, the opinion was really, it was like a judge who had had enough, right? Can you talk about that?
One nice thing about our court system in the United States and federal court judges is many of them do not have patience for people who seek to manipulate the court system in order to kind of torture other people or to bring claims that are essentially frivolous. As critical as the opinion was of X-Corp and Elon, the oral argument was 100 times worse. Judge really grilled the lawyers for X-Corp, and they were completely unable to answer his questions. And as a lawyer representing a client, you never want to be in that position. It's obviously, it's a bad position for you to be in personally because your reputation matters. And it's a terrible position for any client to be in. It was very clear from that opinion, from that argument that they were going to lose. And one thing I should point out is California, I think, has the first anti-SLAPP law in the country. And he made it very clear that under the California law now, CCDH is going to be able to recover its costs and fees.
Can you explain to me and what SLAPP laws are and what they mean just for people who are not completely read in on this?
The whole point of SLAPP laws is basically to prevent lawsuits like this. The point is that if you bring a lawsuit, the point of which is to stifle someone's speech, and the point of the suit is to make them go through all these burdens and costs by suing them, that is what's called a SLAPP lawsuit. And there are statutes in various states, including California, New York, and elsewhere, that basically say, in that kind of situation, the court can basically, A, number one, require you to meet a pretty high standard to be able to go farther in the case, although that wasn't even necessary here. And two, to make you pay costs if you lose to try to deter people from doing this in the future.
That's the most powerful thing for us is that, funnily enough, because I'm British by origin, even though I live in Washington, D.C., in the UK, if you bring a lawsuit against someone and you lose, you pay both sides' costs. And that deters people from bringing frivolous lawsuits. Whereas in the US, because each side pays their own costs, it's really important that we got the cost shifting in this case. Because otherwise his bullying would have worked in one respect. It would have worked because he would have, you know, his aim was to try and bleed us as much as possible. I mean, it's funny because, you know, we talk a lot about bullying is really at the heart of a lot of how Elon behaves. And I read Walter Isaacson's biography of him. This is a guy who was bullied when he was young. It's almost sort of banal how simple the psychology is. This guy who was bullied when he was young, had a really difficult upbringing with his father. And then when he became a grown-up, he bought the playground. He changed the playground so that he's the most important kid on the playground. He bought himself a crown and he put the crown in his head and he walks around the playground saying, I'm the king of the playground. And then someone came along and said, hey, sorry, Elon, actually, you're behaving like an asshole. Actually, you're all Larry. You know, Nazis, white supremacists to run riot over this playground. He sues the kid who's doing that. And what was really interesting about the way the judge, I didn't think he was exasperated. I think it was more of that measured, calm tone that you get when the teacher finally arrives on the playground and goes, Elon, what are you up to? Get back in class, young man. And I think that really, you know, it really was one of those moments. But I mean, I've said before that, you know, I feel a lot of sympathy for Elon. I know what it's like to grow up with a difficult situation at home. And I learned a lot about bullying growing up as well. The difference between me and Elon is that whereas he buys the playground, I know that the only way that you can ever stand up to bullies is to actually stand up to them. And we did. Yeah. And it turns out that bullies, they're often kind of damaged themselves, you know? And I think he's really exposed how damaged he is. This free speech absolutist who seeks to silence people using lawfare. How pathetic.
I'm like so uninterested in him, but I am interested in this idea of a sort of Trumpist-y right-wing world that works very hard to use the legal system to try to silence speech, which, Robbie, this is not the first time you've seen a conservative, or I want to say a Trumpist, because even though we don't know if Ilhan is going to become a Trumpist, he certainly is well on the path. I worry more about this sort of like, you know, book banning, anti-speech crusade by that crew. But it sounds like legally the courts are not very delighted by this.
Yeah, I think that's, first of all, let me begin by saying I have nothing to add really to what Imran just said. That was the perfect statement of the situation that he and our client was in. In terms of the courts, that's exactly right. Look, there are a lot of legitimate disputes, criminal and civil, that need to get litigated in the courts every day. The courts, for the most part, are overburdened, underpaid, overworked.
Yeah.
And as a result, the idea that they have to essentially spend their time, you know, dismissing frivolous claims like this, the whole point of which is fundamentally inconsistent with our First Amendment, tends to aggravate them. And you can see why if you think about it for a second.
Yes. Yes, definitely true. So California, with the slap laws, can you just explain a little bit about the jurisdiction?
Yeah, that's where Twitter is located. So they brought the case to California. They had the right to do that. You know, there are a lot of tech cases in California. And so I think they actually thought that would be a good place for them. It turns out it was not.
I feel like that's amazing. I mean, now where are you with the case?
So they said yesterday, they issued a very brief statement on Twitter, X Corp, saying that they intended to appeal. I'm going to take them at their word that they intend to do that. I don't think their prospects before the Ninth Circuit are any better than they were before Judge Breyer, but we'll see.
The truth is that we're up for this. We'll beat them again. This has been, you know, this is kind of a classic example of the Streisand effect. The truth is that all they've done is given us more voice at CCDH. They've given us more credibility. We've now seen off an attempt to disparage and destroy our research capacity. And the truth is that it's also brought us in thousands of new donors, people who are giving recurring donations. It's actually made us a stronger organization, and it's baffled, hardened my team. So bring it on, Ilhan.
You'll be shocked to hear that you guys are not the only people I've had on this podcast in the last month who are being sued by Ilhan. Are you surprised that this man who has so much capital and is, you know, controls so many important public companies has such bad judgment? I'm just curious about that.
When I started CCDH, I remember going to someone for advice. He's quite a well-known comedian, movie star. And I said to him, like, you know, I have to run an organization. It's a really serious job. You're kind of just an anarchic funster. And he said to me, that's nonsense. I have really good lawyers. I have really good rights. I have really good security. I think about everything. And it's only because I have the basics in place that I'm able to be creative. And it really struck me. It really humbled me because it made me realize to what extent, even as the front person for an organization, you are dependent upon organization and discipline and professionalism. And I think that one of the problems that Ilhan has is that he's not listening to those people. It's really important that you do listen. And it's really clear that he thinks that he's a great businessman. He thinks that he is some kind of wild, you know, entrepreneur who can do whatever he can. He's got the Midas touch. But actually, you know, look at everything he's done on X. The irony is that every single thing that's gone wrong for X that he's blamed everyone else for, that is proof that his touch isn't Midas's touch. He turns anything to do with X and turns it to shit. There is a lesson to be learned. They will write textbooks about this one day, how not to manage a company, how not to behave as a CEO.
You know, there's so many sort of unforced errors. So to talk about this sort of online hate that you're seeing, I mean, what worries you more, the online hate or the misinformation, the foreign actors? I mean, what is the sort of thing that keeps you up at night?
Look, I mean, so disinformation and hate are intrinsically interlinked. I mean, you know, especially when it comes to things like anti-Semitism, which is one of our major areas of study. Anti-Semitism has always been based on lies, whether it's the blood libel 2,000 years ago, it's the protocols of the Elders of Zion in the 20th century that informed Hitler's ideology, or in the 21st century, it's the Great Replacement Theory. And we are interested in why it is that lies get hyper-amplified on these platforms. Because, of course, the way that platforms really work is they don't present you with everyone's posts What they do is they order it into a timeline, and that's run by algorithms which are designed for commercial purposes, and they amplify the most controversial content first. And I think the net effect of that on society is a bit like climate change. The temperature's rising every day. Icebergs are melting. I started this work because my colleague was assassinated in the British Parliament during the EU referendum, the Brexit referendum. We saw the massive rise of anti-Semitism on the left in the UK. We saw other things happening around the world, Bolsonaro, Duterte. And as we see more icebergs melting, as we see more forest fires, more hurricanes, what terrifies me is that we don't have enough time to save democracy before people realize that something fundamental has shifted, that it's because it's a negative byproduct of the digitization of our economy. And unless we put some rules in place, we put some transparency in place, some accountability in place, we may not have a long time to save democracy, especially this year. There are over 2 billion people going to vote. And this is a year in which democracy has to stand strong against authoritarianism. So you want to know what makes me worry at night? I'm Afghan. My family are Afghan. In the 70s, we had women in government. We had women in miniskirts walking around Kabul. And what worries me is, what happens if our democracy crumbles? Because empires do collapse. And lies and hate, they are two of the things that can collapse, even an empire, a civilization as great as the United States today.
Again, I have not a word to add to that. Imran is one of the very few people who, like, makes me silent.
Robbie, what keeps you up at night?
Exactly the same thing. I mean, I say, and I really believe this, that as an American, I believe that we are in a moment in which the survival of our democracy is very much in question. One of the single greatest contributing factors to that is how siloed people are, how amenable, how open they are to misinformation and disinformation, how unwilling they are to have discourse civilly with people who they disagree with. And a lot of that, not all of it, but a lot of that can be blamed on social media and the danger of these algorithms.
Oh, I'm very depressed. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Molly.
Thanks so much, Molly.
Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor at Slate, host of the podcast Amicus, and author of Lady Justice. Welcome back to Fast Politics, my Supreme Court, I want to say, guru, my person, the person who I want to be if I ever grow up, which I never will, but maybe I will. Dahlia, thank you.
There was an awesome moment, Molly, where Justice Kagan said, in casting about for someone who had standing to bring this Mifepristone suit, said, "Where is your person?" So I am your person and Justice Kagan's person. I am the person.
So often with the Supreme Court, we are just bracing for them to remake our country in some terrifying conservative weirdness. But today it did seem like this case, and I think, like, I feel like this case is like the canary in the coal mine. Like, it's definitely coming, but it may not be this that does it.
Yeah, and I think what I would say is this is a marker for a couple of things. One is that cases that come from Judge Matthew Kaczmarek's court in Amarillo, Texas, that are deranged and then come up through the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is deranged. By the time they make their way to the Supreme Court, Overton windows have been flung open, Molly. Like, now it's like we're going to get a, hey, 8-1 or 7-2. The Supreme Court says these doctors had no standing. That doesn't make this court normal. That just means it's not as crazy as the craziest person seeking to impose a nationwide ban on Mifepristone.
So what I was struck by, and I just listened to some of it, and I am not a lawyer, was that Alito has brain worms.
He just has abortion derangement syndrome. I mean, I think there's yes, like a really good piece to be written, and I guess I just assigned it to myself.
Yes. That is, I can't wait to read it.
What if you used his theory of standing for any other area of the law? Like, imagine if you could, like, you know, sue the EPA over climate change, or imagine, you know, because somebody had their feelings hurt. And the fact that Alito has his feelings hurt, and so his heart goes out to a clutch of doctors who have their feelings hurt by the fact that mifepristone is in the world. Just, I think, to me, highlights the fact that, you know, Leah Lippman's been saying this forever, my friend who teaches at Michigan, but, you know,
From Strict Scrutiny.
Yeah, at the Strict Scrutiny podcast, but it's just feelings all the way down. And so there was this amazing back and forth where several of the justices, including the conservative justices, were like, this handful of doctors who doesn't want to someday have a person who is prescribed mifepristone by someone else who then has extremely rare complications stagger into their office so that they have to be quote unquote complicit in something bad is not a theory of standing. It's not a theory of Article III standing. It's a theory of feelings. And the fact that Alito, who only has feelings, he has all the feelings, is the mayor of Feelingstown should surprise nobody.
Right.
I mean, they kept pressing Aaron Hawley, that's Josh Hawley's wife, who was representing the plaintiffs, and they kept saying, like, explain to us why it is that state and federal conscience laws that already allow a physician to opt out if they don't want to provide abortion care, why those laws are insufficient, why you have to take mifepristone from every single physician and person in America. And her answer was some version of complicity, complicity, complicity. And that's not an answer.
Yeah. What I think when we were talking about shifting the Overton window, which I think is really what this argument, this oral argument was about, right, was this is they're not going to get mifepristone this time, but they're smart enough to be setting the table for next time. And so one of the things that I was struck by was, you know, their problem was standing, right? They didn't have the standing because it's a made up case. You know, nobody is injured. I mean, the whole idea of the law is that you have a plaintiff, right?
Yeah, you have to have a plaintiff and they have to have what's known as a cognizable injury. Something has to have happened to them. And even amongst the doctors who submitted declarations in this case, nobody actually had something happen to them. Even, as I said, justices like Kavanaugh and the Chief Justice and Amy Coney Barrett, who probably are very solicitous of the argument that mifepristone is just bad because I don't like it, even they couldn't seem to find anything to hang this onto. And they kept saying, like, there's much narrower relief available than banning mifepristone nationwide for everyone.
When Alito was talking about Comstock, what got me very anxious was he was going on and on about how Comstock isn't some weird thing, when in fact it is, right? I mean, can you talk about that?
Yeah, the Comstock Act of 1873 was this completely
1873. That happened in 1873,
baby,
right.
And it was this like anti-vice, anti-obscenity, anti-porn law that was entirely the brainchild of one religious zealot who liked pawing through people's mail.
Who happened to also be pro-choice, right? That piece in the Washington Post says that actually nearing his death, he said he believed that some abortions were okay.
He just mostly seems to have been very proud of driving people to suicide by going through the mails. And this law has been defunct for all intents and purposes. And, you know, today, I'm sorry, and then at the arguments, you have Justice Alito saying, making it sound as though this is, you know, good law. And he kept saying this is a prominent provision. It's not some obscure subsection, as though, you know, we all live under Comstock and we don't know it. And it's this weird wish casting where he's like hoping to instantiate a world in which we are all bound by Comstock, that nobody can put anything in the mails and you can't put abortion devices in the mails and you can't put information about abortion in the mails. Like, he's acting as though that's already the case. And it's probably just worth saying, Molly, we know that if Donald Trump is elected, the people who want to run his Justice Department will take the position that Comstock is good law on day one.
Yeah. And Comstock, it has really not been used regularly in about 100 years. So this is like, you know, it was wildly popular from 1873 to 1952 or whatever. But it hasn't, it's really not anything that anyone uses today, which is why that Alito is, I always feel like Alito is the one who's telling you what the Heritage Foundation is working on.
Right. I mean, surprising no one ever, 2 years ago, it was Alito that was citing witch burners, right? As though that was good law. So I think it's fairly safe to say that if he still thinks that Sir Matthew Hale, who said you could beat your wife, is a good legal source, then Comstock must be good law as far as he's concerned. And I get it, I suppose. But I think you're exactly right. Like, the slippage here is saying, no, this isn't some obscure law. This is, you know, the cloud under which we all operate. And it's almost like they're really, really hoping that by saying it enough times, they'll make it so and thus do away with abortion nationwide.
Yeah, which is definitely where all of this is going. I mean, how do you think this ends up splitting?
I mean, listening to arguments, I felt like it was kind of 8-1 that there's no standing here. And, you know, with wiggle room, right? Saying like maybe if the states come, they'd have standing, which is something that Judge Kaczmarek is already starting to tee up. And certainly seeing some of this Comstock nonsense, you know, like a loaded gun on the table for the next time round. So, yeah, I think that you'll probably get some grumpy dissent, maybe from Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, saying like, they don't need no stinking standing. This already violates Comstock. And then, right, all the papers will herald like, oh, look at how moderate the court was on Mifepristo. Like, they've sure learned their lesson. And I think this is one of those, like we said at the beginning, Overton window cases, where the only lesson to have been learned is any case that comes from the Fifth Circuit comes with the stink of overreach. That doesn't mean the Supreme Court is doing bang up law.
Right, exactly. Don't give them a pass on this.
Yeah.
On the very rare occasion that this Supreme Court doesn't do something insane, you know, we want to like reward them and be like, maybe they're not all. But I think it is really important. Like when you listen to that, you really see that Thomas and Alito will do anything to roll back women's reproductive health.
Right. And that they'll do it on a theory that would apply to no other area of the law, which is that some doctor might have some moderately bad thing happen from which they're already shielded by conscience laws. And that is so unacceptable that we should take abortion pills, which are the safest, easiest means of terminating a pregnancy for over 60% of American pregnant people. And it's so myopic and self-indulgent and also religiously bonkers that to suggest that, oh, well, they didn't go for it doesn't suggest much other than we only, you know, need to wait for this to come next time. Yep.
I listen to your podcast.
Thank you. I listen to yours.
You're welcome. And it's very, very, very good. And everyone should listen to it. I mean, you know, I'm a huge fan of yours, but you're so smart. And when I was listening to Amicus Slate, I joined. So whatever it is that I don't have to listen to ads. But when I was listening to Amicus, you had an incredibly good interview with a woman who is both a lawyer and a doctor, Carrie Ann Baker. And she talked about how much anti-choice activists worked hard at every point to try to keep this drug from coming to the United States. And I just was curious if you could talk a little bit about the sort of legacy of methapristone and just how, you know, they really acted in this really crazy way about it.
It was such a like scales fall off my eyes moment, Molly, because I thought I knew this case pretty well and I thought I knew medication abortion pretty well. And I thought that all these decades of roadblocks and overregulation, you know, how is it possible that mifepristone, you know, for decades has been legal in most other countries and over the counter as it should be, and none of these restrictions that are only now, finally, we can, you know, get it through telemedicine. You don't have to be in person. You can put it in the mail. Why are we decades behind other places? And what she helped explain is that this was the plan all along, that even when it was being developed in France, American anti-choice activists were terrorizing the scientists and terrorizing the regulators, that it has been the reason the FDA did this in these sort of mincing baby steps that always made a drug that, let's be honest, it's safer than Tylenol, it's safer than Viagra. Millions and millions of people have used it. And the reason it was so wildly overregulated is not because it was a dangerous drug or not because the FDA didn't know what it was doing, but because the same tactics that were used to close clinics, shutter clinics, demand that clinics have extra wide hallways and HVAC systems, all of the things that were being directed at abortion clinics for surgical abortions were also being directed at mifepristone. And so the result is you have this drug that takes decades to come on the market in ways that are comparable to other countries. And we all are sitting there saying, it must be a super crazy dangerous drug. Nothing of the sort. It was by design made to look dangerous by those who didn't want it. And the other thing she said, and I thought this was almost more compelling, Molly, and she was unbelievable, is that if you have devoted, as the anti-choice folks have, decades to shuttering clinics, to having abortion doctors, you know, terrorized and murdered, and to throwing bricks through the windows of places where surgical abortions are administered and yelling at people as they walk into a clinic and calling it free speech, and having crisis pregnancy centers set up next door to clinics so that you can direct people away. Like, that whole battalion of actions goes away if a doctor can just prescribe mifepristone in a telemedicine appointment, or you can just get it in the mail. So this really blows up the entire decades-long post-Roe strategy of terrorizing women, terrorizing physicians, terrorizing clinic workers, because all that goes away. And so this is the whole enchilada to get rid of medication abortion, because there's no strategy if you can't do all those things that have worked for years to shutter clinics around the country.
One of the things the Heritage Foundation is working on next, and I read it on their website, so I know it's true, is they hate all regulation except when it comes to women's bodies. They want to regulate IVF. And if you read this, what they have on the website, it's like dangerous and expensive and there's no protocol and why isn't it regulated? And it just struck me as we talk about these Republican justices trying desperately to get this medicine off the market, that regulation is where they're going with a lot of this.
Right. And not just regulation, but remember the promise of Dobbs. We talked about this a little bit when you came on my show, but the promise of Dobbs was this was going to be left to the states. And the justices were out of the abortion business, much less the life begins at personhood, you know, all of that stuff business. That was the promise, right? And that was always a lie. We knew that was a lie. We read Clarence Thomas's concurrence saying, oh, by the way, we're coming for your birth control. We're coming from LGBTQ rights and same-sex marriage. Like, it's all coming down. And I think we just contented ourselves that they were telling us the truth. But you're exactly right. When you read the Alabama IVF, that Supreme Court decision, which is, by the way, entirely theological and in no way constitutional, what's really, really clear is that the end game here is fetal personhood and the end game is a national ban. And you're completely right that anybody who thought that because they told us in Dobbs that it stops at abortion and it stops at the state, anyone who thought that was like not the most glorious Lucy football in the history of Lucy footballs, just, I guess those are the people who are surprised now that they're coming for IVF.
No, we're not, unfortunately. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Dahlia. You are awesome. I so appreciate getting to talk to you. You were the person I absolutely wanted to talk to about this.
And you are my person, too. And you're probably Justice Kagan's person. She just doesn't know it yet. Thanks, Molly.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Jesse Cannon.
Molly Jung Fest, we've all been waiting for a gag on Trump, but We got that in somewhat form in a legal order today. Tell me what you're seeing here.
So the judge presiding over Donald Trump's criminal trial is no dum-dum. And he has already ordered a gag order on Donald Trump. You'll notice this follows Donald Trump truthing. Remember Truth Social, his highly overvalued meme stock of a company, which is now trading today publicly. It's a SPAC. It's a scam. It's whatever. Maybe it's not a scam. Maybe it's really worth billions of dollars.
I think those Bibles he's selling are the real scam.
I liked the gold sneakers. This is in a rambling and angry post on his social media site, Truth Social. On Tuesday, Mr. Trump made ominous references to Mr. Cohen, claiming without explanation that his former fixer was death. This is never a good thing to do. He also referred to one of Mr. Bragg's prosecutors in pejorative terms. Both comments would now arguably violate the gag order. He's gagged, but that doesn't mean he'll stop. As we've seen before, nothing makes Donald Trump stop. And his big mouth and his itchy thumbs, because he truths with his thumbs, that is our moment of fuckery.
That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah! And some waves so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that!
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in!
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it!
Tenor girl go shopping.
Yeah, baby!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.